the committee would come to order, please. We turn off the banjo music. This is a continuation of the State Affairs meeting from May 5th. It is now Friday, May 6th, approximately 3 o'clock in the afternoon. I'd like to take up action on House Bill 94 first. Did we try and get in touch with Mr. Sonneman?
Yes.
Oh, okay. He was here to testify yesterday, was not able to stay until the end. I did see him in the hallway today. The bill does have at least one additional committee of referral, but hopefully he will come in before we finalize any action today. So at this point, we have Senator Davis has offered an amendment. And why don't we title that amendment number one? And Senator Davis, would you like to move the amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move amendment one.
Okay, I will object. Do you want to offer some explanation? And I'm not sure, Senator Davis.
I got this information. Do I have one?
Did you have this passed out to all the members? This memo from Mr.
Yes, Sons? I did.
Okay.
I had a memo that came from him, and I passed it out. I might not have left one over there, but I do have it. And Mr. Seitz might be online.
Okay.
By the other seat over there.
And Senator, it's my understanding basically your amendment would go back to Section 57, which was in the House bill that was transmitted to us. The only change between your version and what was previously in the bill is that on page 2 of the amendment, line 7, the House sent it over, and you can see there in the bracketed language, the current statutory language is 3%.
Yes.
The House sent it over, and they just lowered it to 2%. And Mr. Sykes has suggested in this amendment as it stands, suggest to take it to 1 1/2 of 1%. So, Senator, is there any further explanation or?
Actually, I think the explanation is given on the paper that I passed out to you, and it seems like that would be fair in the sense that it would take a smaller number of votes for that party to be registered. And for that reason, I think it's worth at least putting out as an amendment. Let's see what others might think about it.
Let's see. Mr. Sykes, are you on teleconference? Okay. I thought maybe he'd called in again today. Well, as I testified yesterday, the current statutory language was just put in by the legislature last year. And I know that was based on some court findings that that determined that the 3% standard was supportable. And so for myself, just personally at this point, I'd rather see a little bit more time transpire with the 3% to see how that impacts things. And so just for myself, I'll be voting no on the amendment.
Mr. Chairman, before the 3% was put in there, what was it before that?
Let's see. I think.
Sorry.
Let me see. Mr. Balash, if you could come forward. The 3%, it was previously 3%, but then last year the bill put into place the cascading standard.
Is that correct?
For the record, my name is Joe Balash, staff of Budget and Audit Committee. The 3% standard had been applied to the governor's race, and so you had this party qualification status opportunity, if you will, come up only every 4 years instead of on an ongoing basis. Last year's action instituted the cascading test, looking at statewide races. So the 3% standard, I believe Mr. Sykes told us yesterday, was picked up in 1996, but I don't have any independent knowledge of that.
But it has been on the books, and the change again last year was because the 3% was based on the gubernatorial election, then parties could only hope to test and reach that standard every 4 years. With the change that we made last year, if it's not a gubernatorial year, then you go to, is it U.S. Senate race? And if it's not U.S. Senate race, then you go to the U.S. House race. Is that correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
Because we were looking for the race that would attract the most participation from voters, because if you're trying to measure a modicum of support amongst Alaska voters, you want the race that attracts the most participation. So personally, I feel comfortable with sticking with that standard. So
with that cascade, then you could qualify every year rather than every 4 years?
Well, every 2 years, you're guaranteed that there will be a race that if your party reaches that hurdle, you'll be able to qualify. You won't have to wait till the fourth year and hopefully reach the hurdle on the gubernatorial year in particular. So
I was looking for the paper that I was reading that he had passed out on saying what other states were doing on that, and there were some numbers on it. Maybe it was on this page.
If we could have Ms. Glazer come forward. Are you
right here?
Were you just bouncing your foot there because I've made a misstatement, or is there something that needs to be clarified?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Laura Glazer, Director of Division of Elections. Just to further clarify, you're correct. It was previous to the changes in House Bill 414 made last year. It was the governor's race as the marker, the banner race to qualify. But there's always been an additional means to qualify, and that's the percentage of voters that a party has registered to that affiliation. So there are parties, and in fact part of the other section dealing with recognized political party status deals with that fact, because a party can also qualify as a recognized party by the number of voters it has registered in its party. So as a result, a party can have 1 month have 7,500 and the next month have 6,800. So they're qualified, they're not qualified, they're qualified, they're not qualified. What we wanted to ensure, we did in the House version, and any changes you've made to version R also sustain, is the fact that you don't block one of those parties who achieve status through that means from gaining status at any time. So they aren't blocked just in a gubernatorial year or just in a U.S. Senate year or just in a U.S. House year. That there is always that as an additional means to obtain or retain status. You may achieve status by nominating a candidate with a certain percentage of voters who voted for your candidate. And then you may lose it in the following year. Say you had a gubernatorial candidate under the current law. You had a gubernatorial candidate that achieved a certain percentage of votes. And then you don't have a U.S. senator who achieves that percentage of votes. You could still meet the test by having 3% of the registered voters. So there's always two options for by which a party can maintain their status. So I just wanted to add that so that didn't seem like it was all hanging on one marker. There are two different ways to maintain and retain status.
Thanks for that explanation. Thank you. But how many states use the numbers that we now have in place?
Senator Davis, through the chair, I'm not certain that the chart that's before you, I haven't weighed it out. There are some that have higher standards, some that have lower. It was addressed in the court decision most recently that the court said that they thought that Alaska standards were fair. But I can't tell you that, you know, more than 10 or less than 10. Not all states give two ways by which you can achieve status, meaning some are just a percentage of a certain race, and some are a percentage of registered voters. In Alaska, we have both as options to retain status.
Thank you.
Okay. Is there further debate on amendment number one? I'm going to maintain my objection, so we'll have a roll call vote.
Yes.
Senator Huggins?
No.
Yes.
Chair Terrio?
No. Okay, and then Laura, was there any particular question that came up in the discussion yesterday? That just needed to be responded to or clarified with any questions that came up in the testimony and whatnot on the bill that you feel need to be responded to?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Senator Elton did request whether there was a document that showed what other states do, and it was passed out for you today. This sheet, it is old, meaning it came out, we were given it last year when this bill was before the House. And so then it goes state by state, showing what a party must do to nominate without petitioning. Additionally, Senator Elton asked, what was the difference between who would qualify as a party under current state law versus who would qualify under the version that passed the House? And that's the document that has the grid lines on it, and it will show you the different parties that qualify. That qualify under current state law and would have qualified should the House version have been in effect. And I just picked 3 years. And the reason we did 2004, 2002, and 2000 is because in 2000 it was a year where there was no governor and there was no U.S. Senate race. So the test year would have been the U.S. representative year. So that's why we went back the 3 election cycles.
Senator Elton, go ahead.
Sarah, as I read this table, unless I've forgotten how to read tables, there would have been no difference under the proposal in House Bill 94 and current state law on which parties would have qualified. I mean, it looks to me as if in 2004 the same parties qualified under either version. In 2002 the same parties would have qualified under either version. In 2000 either version is
Senator Elton, through the chair. The way I read the table, there, more parties qualified under the House version. Because if you'll note, where it's 2% of those who voted for U.S. representative, if the representative was the test race for qualification at that time, yes, the R's and the D's usually qualify under any scenario. AIPs normally qualify under the standard of a percentage of voters attributed to that party. What gets added in is when you test in different races to achieve your percentage of votes. Does that make sense?
It does. Mr. Chair, if I could follow up. It seems to me that, I mean, what I was doing was looking at the highlighted, the three lines that have the highlighted text that says parties who would have qualified about a third of the way down, about two-thirds of the way down, and then at the bottom. And then I'm reading across, and it seems to me that results are the same under either version.
Senator Elton, through the chair, and I'm sorry that probably the prior line should have been, and I'm sorry, we were working on the RFP for the voter system today as well. That which is bolded, that you say remains the same, is the test of not whether you achieved your status by having a candidate who received a certain percentage of votes, but rather that you have voters who have that number of voters. So you're right. If the only test in this state were the percentage of those who voted either in a race or who had registered voters, those would be the three parties that have qualified year after year, the APES, the D's, and the R's.
Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Okay. So, House Bill 94 is back before us. We do have one more person who has signed up to testify. I'd like Merle Thompson to come forward.
Hello. Merle Thompson, Sioux Sittna Valley, testifying for myself. I sat through this HB 94 in quite a number of committees throughout much of this session. It actually had quite a review in quite a number of committees on the House side. It had its problems at one point, but over the process, it turned out to be one very good bill, and I have to compliment Ms. Glazier for the work that she put in it, and a lot of the other people that testified and worked on committees on it. It seems in a very short time there's some very big problems that have emerged, and that's since I believe this version R come out. I haven't had a chance to go over the whole thing with a fine-tooth comb by any means, but I certainly see a problem in sections 11, 12, and a new paragraph in 13. And like I say, this has kind of hit me relatively recently, but it looks to me like we're going back to the 1990s when we had an infusion of soft money in Alaska politics. And seems to me we're going absolutely 180 degrees the wrong way with these particular additions to this bill, which prior to this was a very good bill. I'm not sure who would want to add these soft money provisions, and I can't imagine what reasons that you would want to add. Big money seems to be ruining the political process, and this last election is the perfect example where multi-millions of dollars were spent in this state on the senatorial race, and I ran in a legislative race, and all the available airtime in my area was bought up by outside money, and it was very hard for us to get any time on airwaves or anything else for that matter, especially TV. So the problem that we're facing now is big money, and the worst form of big money is soft money. And that seems to be what's being added in sections 11 and 12 and 13 for party building. Now, if this last amendment would just kind of make it a little rougher for other parties to even get in on the play. So in essence, what we have is we have two parties benefiting, possibly three, depending on the vote. And everybody else, and me being an independent, doesn't, in fact, it works totally against anybody that wants to be an independent, which I think maybe there ought to be more people that are independents from the way things are going. So we have, in this state, 51% of the people that are registered to vote, they're not members of any party. They have elected not to be a member of any party. So right off the bat, this soft money is going against the majority of the people in the state that have registered to vote. Right off the bat, it's working against the majority. Now, the Republican Party is the largest party in this state. Still yet, they're only just a tad over 25% of the registered voters, and I believe about 13% of the actual population of this state. I can see where this would benefit somebody like Randy Riedrich, who is the head of that particular party, but it's not a benefit for anybody else, and there's no stretch of the imagination that can make this a benefit for the people or the voters of Alaska. This is a very bad addition to what was a very good bill, and I believe I think I might have gotten my point across on that. And that's all I need to really say on it.
Thank you. Do we have questions?
No, I would be interested if you could expound on Merle in particular on Section 11, what specifics you took advantage of or exception to. It's Section 11.
Okay.
What portion you think?
The addition, Senator Huggins, would be subsection 6, the dark black underlined, which is the same, I believe, in Section B on the next page. And Section 13, Subsection 17, the party building part, which, like I mentioned, the majority of the state isn't in a party to begin with. Seems to me that that's inviting soft money in all three of those sections. We certainly need campaign finance reform, but that this is going the wrong way.
And just a question on page 11 there, the new section 13, the end of that section. But so it talks about the organization of the precincts, the voters registration drives, but clarifies at the end, but does not include an express communication or electioneering communication. And you talked about all the ads that ran in the election last year. None of this money would be able to be used to run those types of ads, nor could it flow through the party to the candidates to run those type of ads. So I'm wondering, in that list of things there that a party can do, and that's Republican Party, the Green Party, Libertarian Party, to be able to raise funds to do those functions, which of those functions do you find particular problem? Find a particular problem?
Well, since the 13 and 12 and 11 are slightly different, and I kind of generalized on all three things, I was referring to the other two sections on the particulars of advertising when I was talking earlier.
But the money that's raised in 11, 12, they're all tied together. But the one that controls the activity is Section 13.
The way I'm reading it, it seems like soft money. And if I'm wrong, would you correct me, or at least
soft money would be able to be used to register voters, organize precinct meetings, a district picnic, things of that nature,
mm-hmm.
but could not be used for any kind of advocacy on a particular candidate's behalf, advertising, saying vote for candidate X, things of that nature.
I see it benefiting parties. We've already had an amendment that seems to be just shot down, so that's kind of like leaving parties to a minority of the registered voters in this state, where in that context, it means the majority of the registered voters are not benefiting by this. And like I say, this was a good bill without this. It's just a bad bill with it. Maybe you can explain to me what good normal folks in Alaska is going to get out of these provisions, or I understand what good a political party will get out of this, or especially the larger of the political parties, but I see not what benefits the 51% of us that aren't in a major party. And if you added the smaller parties that probably won't even qualify as a party now because of an amendment that was just shot down, we're talking a great deal more than 51%.
Senator Elton.
Thanks. And a question of the sponsor, maybe Joe, if he wants to. It seems to me, and I tend to agree with Merle's testimony, but it seems to me that another consequence of Section 13 is that if you allow soft money to conduct these activities, you're freeing up hard money to conduct the other activities that Merle is concerned about.
Joe. And I know that we had testimony yesterday about the federal limitations on the expenditure, and maybe you should touch on those again.
Thank you. I'll touch on the federal law first, just to make that absolutely clear. Because of BCRA, Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act, the activities of a state party come under the auspices of the FEC code, because every election has at least one federal race, that being the race for congressman. And so the 60 days prior to the general election and the 60 days prior to the primary election, there is nothing that a state party can do without using federal dollars, and that means hard dollars from private sources.
So the restrictions, the federal restrictions within that 60-day window?
60, and in Alaska, they run concurrently.
Has to follow the federal law that is an outright prohibition of any use of soft money for those purposes.
In any race?
Correct.
In any race.
The state party may not, because everything the state party does benefits that federal candidate. And so to the extent that the Alaska Democratic Party in the 2004 election received fairly large sums from the DSCC, all of that money had to be hard money because of BICRA.
Thanks, and thanks for the patience. But I mean, despite BICRA, if you have hard and soft money, and if you use the soft money to free up hard money, how can that hard money be used in a legislative race, for example? Not a federal race, but a state race.
The hard money, through the chair, Senator Elton, the hard money would then be used to cover all expenses of the state party in that 120-day period. And the state law allows the parties to give hard dollars to candidates, so they can make cash contributions, they can make independent expenditures, they can do voter ID, voter turnout, and open, for lack of a better term, a war room, if you will, you know, opening up temporary campaign space, so they would have to lease that space or otherwise obtain it.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
And so the assumption is the more soft money that does activities like this, the more hard money there will be for the activities that you just described.
Mr. Chairman, I think that's a fair argument.
Well, and I guess for myself, the more soft money to encourage people to register to vote is not a problem in my mind. More soft money to encourage people to participate in the process of nomination, you know, up through precincts or to district meeting, I personally don't have a problem with that. The testimony about all the ads and buying up the airtime and whatnot that took place last year, there were groups that were doing that, and they are subject to state and federal law, but how was it that they were able to get the money to do that?
Mr. Chairman, in the BICRA that passed two years ago, there was a sort of a carve-out for what are known as 527s. That's a reference to the section of the IRS code that they qualify under. And if I'm not mistaken, a 527 does not have to disclose where they get their money or how they spend it. It was a matter that was left up to the FEC, and the FEC, when the question was put to them, split on the issue because it's an even-numbered panel. Because they split, it failed, meaning there's no regulation of them. And so Citizens for a Stronger Senate is one that I recall. I'm trying to think of one on the other side, just to be fair, but I think there was probably one.
And so they are able to raise money, and with what restrictions?
None.
With no restrictions. And they can register people and advocate?
That's correct. One group that I don't think we saw here in Alaska, but did operate at the federal level, was Americans Coming Together, and they did a tremendous voter ID, door-to-door registration, voter contact type of effort, particularly in the state of Ohio, and that was all done with undisclosed, unaccountable money. Now, some of the organizations, including ACT, but also MoveOn.org, we know some of their sources because they were reported publicly, but there's no requirement that they be made public.
Further questions? Senator Elton?
Mr. Chair, I'm going to, I mean, I did a little bit of work on this, these three sections in the small amount of time that we've had, and I have some problems, and I'm going to speak about the problems, and I don't think I'm the only one with problems. We had a conversation with Brooke Miles, the head of APOC, who couldn't see her. She was on a telephone, but her voice and her comments were that she threw up her hands and said, hey, wait a minute. The gist of the problem seems to be that less than a decade ago, we kind of banned soft money. We did an appropriate thing under campaign finance reform. And as Joe mentioned yesterday, the Singleton decision said, well, you can't maybe do it the way you want to do it. And then the Ninth Circuit Court said, well, you can. And so what the addition of these sections appears to me to do is go back to the Singleton approach. It's a rather large paradigm shift in how we have been doing things. And it's a shift that bothers me because what we're ending up with is kind of at the last minute, we're making very substantive changes, not to the way we conduct elections, but to the manner in which we regulate the flow of money into campaigns under the APOC statutes, and because these definitions go to the APOC statutes. And that gives me a great deal of concern. So for that reason, I'm going to move an amendment that we strike sections 11, 12, and 13 from version R that's in front of us, because I think that it's a big paradigm shift from what we're doing. It is something that I think when Alaskans have discussed it outside of this building, they have indicated a strong desire to control soft money. And I think this opens the door to substituting hard dollars with soft dollars so that we can accomplish things that I don't think Alaskans are prepared to accept. I could change my mind, I guess, given time and given a reasonable review of this pretty big shift in policy. But, you know, given the time that we have in front of us till the end of the session, given the importance of the bill, I think, to the Division of Elections, I would encourage us to vote yes to my motion to strike sections 11, 12, and 13.
And just, I think your statement would lead one to believe that you're alleging that the soft money can flow through to campaigns. Which it clearly cannot. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And if it's an issue of, well, you free up hard money, which can go to campaigns, has to be reported, has limitations on out-of-state sources, no corporate, no union, and that money can currently be used for campaigns. So I don't quite understand why APOC would say that there's any new source of funding running into campaigns. It's still hard dollars. And I think it was 4 years ago that I ran the legislation that said no corporate, no union, you know, none of that in the campaigns, and this doesn't change that.
I think that speaks directly to one of my concerns, is I shouldn't and ought not be speaking on behalf of APOC. I can tell you that when we talked to APOC, they said that APOC is not okay with this addition to the election bill. And that gets to the concern that I have, that at this point in the session, we need to know exactly what their problems are, not let me tell you what I think their problems might be with these sections of the bills. And I think that's one of the reasons that convinced me that we need to move ahead with all of the stuff that has been vetted, and that, as some of the people who have testified said, all the work that Laura Glazer has put in on the elections component, I think we need to move ahead with that. And I think we need to have a good conversation with APOC to find out exactly what their problems are.
There's an amendment number two, which I will object to. Is there further debate? Seeing none, we'll have a roll call.
Senator Huggins?
No.
Senator Davis?
Yes.
Senator Elton?
Yes.
Senator Wagner?
No.
Chair Terrio?
No. And Senator Elton, the bill will have at least one more committee of referral to, and I'll certainly get in touch with APOC. For the life of me, I can't see how this really changes anything that they have to track, because the category of money that's available for campaigns is unchanged. Let's see, we have a fiscal note on the bill of $24,000, and the bill does have a finance referral. And with that, Senator Wagner.
I move Senate CS for CS for House Bill Number 94, State Affairs /R, with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Is there an objection to the motion to move? Seeing none, the bill will move to the next committee. That then brings us to House Bill 277. There was a meeting this morning between General Campbell. And if there's any additional testimony. And so I'd like to have the 1-0 fiscal note. We are the only committee of referral on the Senate side. So is there discussion on House Bill 277? Senator Elton?
Sir Chair, the only discussion I've got, unless somebody has questions, is that just a very, very brief report on the meeting that was held this morning. And in my appreciation to General Campbell and to John Kramer, who accompanied him, my appreciation to the member from the governor's office who attended the meeting, and especially my appreciation to the family that was able to make the meeting. The meeting occurred at 8:45 this morning. I think that General Campbell was extremely fair in talking about the hesitations, and to General Campbell's credit, he had been in the loop for about 2.5 weeks. He didn't understand the 3-year history behind this. I'm not going to criticize anybody at all. It's something that sometimes happens in a bureaucracy. And as he listened to Representative Curtula and Thomas and myself and the family, and he understood that there was more of a history than the 2.5 years, he was very sympathetic. He didn't promise anything. He promised the members of the family that he would talk to the office of the governor, and he would report back to Senator Huggins, to myself, and to Representatives Curtula and Thomas. He did that expeditiously and in a very caring manner, and reported back that that he had no problems with the bill. And I won't characterize conversations he may have had with Representative Thomas and Curtula or Senator Huggins' staff, but he indicated to me that he was fine with the bill and supportive of the bill. And I appreciated his involvement in coming down and talking to us.
Is there further debate? Senator Huggins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple comments, and I appreciate, you know, the opportunity to be able to help on this a little bit. And General Campbell, as cited by General or Colonel Elton, is an extraordinarily good guy, compassionate, and wants to do the right thing. I will say that this sort of naming process for National Guard kinds of things, I would hope, is not precedent setting, in that we probably need to review with the DMVA before we get back into this sort of thing. So I would just ask us not to view this as a precedence. It's a good cause. It's a good reason to do things. I just think we need to make sure what the process is in the future for us, so that none of us get caught in this paradigm.
Thank you. Senator Elton, would you like to?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 277 with the attached zero fiscal note, and individual recommendations.
Without objection, the bill will move to committee, its next committee, or actually it'll go to rules with individual recommendations. And with that, we're adjourned for the day.
Good day.